The room was in an uproar, with members of the staff clustering about two young men who were removing outer garments even as they parried the miscellany of questions being thrown at them. Ayton hustled through the crowd and faced the newcomers angrily. "Do you realize it's less than half an hour before deadline? Where have you two been?" Pharaoh 24 seated himself and rubbed his hands. His cheeks were red with the outdoor chill. "Yaimat and I have just finished carrying through a little crazy experiment of our own. We've been trying to see if we couldn't construct an arrangement by which we could simulate the appearance of darkness and stars, so as to get an advanced notion as to how it looked."
A last experiment in the face of the apocalypse. Not a bad way to start an episode.
You know, somebody in the room was like, "Wait, we're doing experiments? Jeremy, kiss me. I just want to try something." Madeline, you get over here too.
Oh, that reading was from Isaac Asimov's Nightfall, a story selected by listener Dave Infinity Mackin, and one that has not disappointed.
Indeed. And our reader on this journey to the stars is a star in his own right. Entertainment Weekly has called him to see if he'd like to subscribe, and the telemarketer told him he has a very pleasing voice. Ladies and gentlemen, Andrew Lehman.
Andrew and the folks at the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society are selling raffle tickets still to aid the hurricane relief in Puerto Rico.
This week's item is the last prop Cthulhu cult / Mego victim that appeared in both The Call of Cthulhu and The Whisperer in Darkness. It was one of the 2 1/5 scale models made for shots of the cult victims in the Louisiana swamp scene and then reused as the victim in the tank in Whisperer. Mm-hmm. This is what's getting raffled off this week along with the tank. It's an amazing and pretty gory prop. I don't know about you, but if I have a prop, I want blood all over it. Otherwise, it's just a knickknack, and I don't have time for that.
No, so, he does.
Yeah. Get your raffle tickets now. They are $2 a piece, and even if you don't win, you know you helped out, and we all need a little of that good stuff on our balance sheet because we are terrible, cruel people who do awful things. So go buy raffle tickets, and then let's get on to the show.
We haven't really talked about Asimov at all.
Yeah.
And I want to amend that.
Let's do it.
He was born on an unknown date between October 1919 and January 2nd, 1920. He picked January 2nd, 1920 to be his birthday, or at least that's what he celebrates. He was born in Russia and emigrated with his family to America when he was 3 years old. He spoke Yiddish with his parents, so he never spoke Russian. He's Jewish, obviously. And he grew up in Brooklyn.
In other words, a person who would frighten and disgust H.P. Lovecraft.
But he married a Jew. I don't understand. I'm so confused. Asimov attended public schools, but then got into Columbia, mostly due to some program to school ethnic groups. But it worked out for him. He studied zoology, but then he moved on to chemistry. He got his master's in chemistry in 1941 and a PhD in biochem in 1948. During that time, however, he worked as a civilian at the Naval Yard in Philadelphia. He was drafted, but due to some clerical issues, he was never shipped off. He then ended up working at Boston University for a while. The whole time he was doing that, he was writing, and eventually he became a full-time writer by 1958.
That was around when he published the book The Naked Sun, the second in his robot series. Mm-hmm. Asimov is really known for writing what you would call hard science fiction.
Yeah.
I guess which just means that it actually has some basis in real science.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of things that we call science fiction are actually epic. You know, Star Wars isn't science fiction.
Science fantasy.
Along with Robert A. Heinlein and Arthur C. Clarke, he is considered one of the big three science fiction writers. Mm. Asimov's most famous work is the Foundation series.
Yep.
And his other major series are the Galactic Empire series and the Robot series.
Yeah.
The Robot series laid down the three laws of robotics, which are sometimes called Asimov's laws. Mm-hmm. Even though this is science fiction, I feel like these laws are going to be incorporated into our daily lives very soon if they're not already.
Mm-hmm.
The rules were introduced in Asimov's 1942 short story Runaround, which is included in iRobot. It's a collection I had when I was a kid. The three laws, quoted as being from the Handbook of Robotics, 56th edition, 2058 AD. Mm-hmm. Hope I live to see that.
Yeah.
Here are the rules. A robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first one. Number two, a robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Mm-hmm.
Third, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second laws.
Yep.
This is all so they don't go crazy and kill us. Asimov, as his career went on in the 80s, did some work to connect all of his books and stories into kind of a shared universe.
Yeah.
The Galactic Empire novels are explicitly set in earlier history of the same fictional universe as the Foundation series.
Mm-hmm.
Later, beginning with Foundation's Edge, he also linked this distant future to the robot and spacer stories. Before he left us, he wanted to make sure that it was all in one kind of world.
Right.
Asimov also wrote the Lucky Star series of juvenile science fiction novels using the pen name Paul French.
Ah, I didn't realize that. You know, Madonna yes. based that song off of that story.
Yeah, I did know that.
He had a heart attack in 1977, which required triple bypass surgery in 1983. During that surgery, however, he got blood that had HIV in it. And he got AIDS and died in 1992. His family kept it under wraps due to the open hostility to gay men and AIDS at the time.
Yeah, that only came out a little later. Such nonsense. Yeah. Now, Asimov's also been in the news just recently. You know me, what I like to do is just read headlines on the internet and then repeat my misunderstanding of them to other people. So yeah. What I read is that SpaceX just shot Asimov's corpse up into space. No. The real story is that when SpaceX launched its rocket into orbit recently, they included a copy of Asimov's The Foundation trilogy. Mm-hmm. Not a paperback or anything. It's laser etched on a quartz disc, which is designed to survive intact for billions of years.
Yeah.
If you're in space and you have free time, I guess you can check it out from the rocket.
Yeah.
And read it as long as you get it back on time. I don't know. But it's fun stuff.
It is fun stuff.
It's fun stuff. I'll tell you that. We're having fun here. Yeah. So what the heck happened last week on Nightfall?
Where we left off, the planet Lagash is about to go into a total eclipse that will last for hours. This is going to freak everybody out because they have never known nighttime because they have six suns. Mm-hmm. This eclipse seems to happen every 2,000 years and civilization totally crumbles each time. We're with a group of scientists and a reporter, Theramon. He thinks it's all BS and is there to report for the paper about all these foolish scientists. Eitan is the scientist in charge, and these two guys just showed up late because they were doing an experiment to see what would happen in an environment where all you can see is stars and no sun. Eitan is angry with them for doing an unauthorized experiment, but they're like, what does it matter?
I feel the same way, Jeremy. I mean, what does it matter? Let's just go crazy, you know what I'm saying? But these guys bought a one-story house down in the city with a domed roof because it's the end of the world and what else are they going to do with their money? So
sure.
Buy some property. They rigged it up with black velvet so as to get as perfect a darkness as possible. And then they punched tiny holes in the ceiling and through the roof and covered them with little metal caps, all of which could be shoved aside simultaneously at the close of a switch. The point being, they want to get the light to shine through these holes in the roof so they can get like a star-like effect, mm-hmm. or what they think a star-like effect will be.
At first, they were creeped out by the dark, but when their eyes adjusted to the artificial stars, they were fine. No crazy times. Theramon says to Sheeran, the sassy fat psychologist that is there with the scientist, this blows your theory away, but Sheeran isn't so sure.
He thinks for a second about why the experiment didn't make them go mad, and then he says, ah, of course, but before he can go on with whatever explanation he's ideated, there's a disturbance up in the dome, and everybody rushes up there to see what it is.
Yeah, up in the dome, this guy has broken in and shattered some photographic plates that were going to be used to document the eclipse. The scientists all jump on the intruder and subdue him. This guy is an end-of-the-world cultist.
Hey, and cults are your favorite thing, right?
I love them. The cultists say that he was after the cameras and breaking the plate was an accident. And Eitan knows him as Latimer 25.
The worst of the Latimers.
Eitan wants to know why he's here since Eitan fulfilled his end of the bargain. Eitan was able to provide proof that what they believed would come to pass. But Latimer said that the proof was sacrilege. Your pretended explanation backed our beliefs and at the same time removed all necessity for them. You made of the darkness and of the stars a natural phenomenon and removed all its real significance. That was blasphemy. Eitan is like, facts are facts, man. And Latimer just calls them lies. Because...
Oh, because he's got faith.
Yeah.
I had a similar situation once where I proved that Dionysus exists. And oh man, were the ancient Greeks mad at me.
Whew. How old are you, Fiverr?
I don't want to talk about that.
Eitan deduces that because people are thinking about it, they aren't looking into it with religious faith, and the cult sees this as damning their soul. Eitan is like, what difference does it make? No one believes us.
It's interesting that the scientists and the cultists are on the same side for once in that they're being ignored by everybody.
Yeah.
Which I guess, you know, there's a little of that going on today. There's less interest in philosophy or faith on the one side. There's less interest on the scientific underpinnings of the universe as well.
Yeah.
There's more interest in celebrities and odd pairings of animals who make friends with each other. That's kind of what people are into. And that includes me.
Yeah.
If it's a choice between church, a lecture, or a video of a baby goat and an abused pit bull, I'm going to choose the video. I mean, look at those guys frolic.
Yeah.
They're just, they're best friends.
Yeah, they just love each other so much.
Oh. So, okay, this cultist broke it.
Eitan wants to call the police, but Sheeran is like, dude, we've got a half an hour before stuff goes completely nuts. I'll handle this.
Eitan says, this is not the time for your monkey shines, Sheeran.
Sheeran says to the cultist, if you promise to behave, we will trust you. To which Latimer says, when I get the chance, I'm going to destroy that machine.
The camera machine, right?
Yes.
The stuff that's gonna document this eclipse.
Right, exactly. Sheeran says, look at that big guy over there. He's going to take you down and he's going to throw you into a closet with no windows. You will be in the dark while the whole eclipse happens. And Latimer's like, so what? I'll starve and die in there. I'm not afraid.
You think the big guy that he pointed to was like, what am I going to do?
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
I know I'm in shape and I'm kind of big, but I'm not into beating people up. Sorry. Don't just assume that I'm going to bounce somebody.
Sheeran says, my dear Latimer, if I lock you in the closet, you are not going to see the darkness and you're not going to see the stars. It does not take much knowledge of the fundamental creed of the cult to realize that for you to be hidden from the stars when they appear means the loss of your immortal soul. Now, I believe you will be an honorable man. I'll accept your word of honor to make no further effort to disrupt proceedings, if you'll offer it.
Bam! Using his religion against him.
Latimer knows he's beaten and promises not to cause any harm. Just then, Theremin points outside with a horrified look on his face. Beta is starting to eclipse.
Just a little thumbnail cut out of it.
They all pause and stare.
There's some shrieking confusion in the background.
Then they just get to their jobs. Sheeran sees Theremin just sitting there, shaking. And he says, losing your nerve? Theremin's like, no, I'm not losing my nerve. I just didn't believe any of this was going to happen until right this minute. So I'm adjusting.
Mm-hmm.
I've got this. Sheeran says that Theremin should take his place at the hideout. But no way. Theremin is a newspaper man. He's got a job to do.
Get me to a row of payphones. I got to call this into the chief. Theremin is a strong reporter, but he does say, man, I'd give my right arm for another bottle of that Socceroo juice, even half the size of the one you bought. If ever a fella needed a drink, I do.
He's hard-boiled, man.
Yeah.
They stop talking and notice the cultist is staring out the window looking at the eclipse, smiling and chanting softly to himself. He's quoting the Book of Revelations, which does a pretty solid job of describing what's going on.
It came to pass that the darkness of the cave fell upon Lagash, and there was no light on all the surface of Lagash. Men were even as blinded, nor could one man see his neighbor, though he felt his breath upon his face. And in this blackness there appeared the stars, in countless numbers, and to the strains of music of such beauty that the very leaves of the trees cried out in wonder. And in that moment the souls of men departed from them, and their abandoned bodies became even as beasts, yea, even as brutes of the wild, so that through the blackened streets of the cities of Lagash they prowled with wild cries. From the stars there then reached down the heavenly flame, and where it touched, the cities of Lagash flamed to utter destruction, so that of man and of the works of man, naught remained.
Latimer catches them staring at him and stops. Strangely, Theremin says to Sheeran, I feel better now. See, what it is that this science stuff is scary, but these cult stories, I've been listening to them since I was a kid and laughing them off. So there's no way that I'm going to let it bug me now. However, he's going to turn his chair away from the window.
I don't want to look, but I am feeling better because that cultist does sound like an idiot. He says, this is the kind of stuff my nurse used to tell me. It's always a nurse, you know? It made me think of, like, old Nan, the nurse in Game of Thrones. It's always the old nurse who scares children when they're young by telling them these fairy tale stories. Is that something that you learn in nursing school? Like, there's a scary fairy tale 101 you take after anatomy? Or maybe that's crone school.
Oh, and my. It
just so happens that a lot of crones end up being nurses.
Could be.
It's important you think critically about this kind of thing.
Yeah, of course.
Crone School would be a great name for a metal band, by the way.
You know, it's funny that you bring up the nurse thing, because I think that idea of the nurse corrupting your child is a fear that has to do with the lower class or maybe foreigners, because a lot of times nurses would be poor people.
Right.
Poor people from other countries.
Yeah.
It's the outside influence kind of like sneaking in through the back door.
Yeah, they've got those ignorant peasant superstitions that they're seeding in the minds of the children.
Which is interesting, because that is kind of a trope that we find in these stories.
Yeah.
The sun is setting. Everything is looking orange and darkening. Sheeran says that the cult is going to have one hell of a membership surge. Theremin wonders that since the Book of Revelations is cycles old, how did it survive the other apocalypses? Were they immune to star madness, maybe, because of their religious beliefs? And Sheeran says, well, there are a few kinds of people that would theoretically be unaffected. Those who don't see the stars, those who are mentally disabled, and those who are super drunk or high.
Or as I like to call them, science fiction writers. Zing! Hey, if anybody's doing a keynote speech at a science fiction writers convention, shoot me an email. I am selling that joke cheap.
Also, children below 6 years of age would be immune to this star madness because the whole world is crazy to them already.
Stars and darkness would be just another item in an already surprising world. And I love that notion that you can get used to anything when you're a kid because it's all crazy. The whole world is a new stimulus to you. When I was a kid, my dad slept with a family of raccoons every night. I didn't know that was weird. It's just everyday life to me. You know, it was only when I got into college that I found out he shouldn't be doing that.
It's really strange because raccoons are nocturnal. That's what's so weird about them.
That's what, yeah, I know.
That's the weird thing.
That's the weirdest thing is that they slept at night. These raccoons did.
So bizarre.
Yeah, big pile around my dad.
So these kids and mentally disabled adults or high adults would survive and try to piece it all together. Mm-hmm. Not the most credible people in the world.
Yeah, it seems like Asimov is subtly saying, these are the kind of people who brought your religion, folks. Children and high people. Maybe a few mentally disabled folks.
Theramon wonders if the survivors did what they're planning to do by building this hideout. Mm-hmm. To which Sheeran says, it doesn't matter how they did it, just that it's based on a flawed understanding. Just as the experiment that the guys did earlier, when he's about to explain why it didn't work, Eitan comes in. The hideout is fine, but the city is already going to crap. Riots and bedlam.
Cars overturned, looting, fires. It's almost like their team won the championship out there.
The cult has gotten people together and promised them salvation if they storm the observatory.
Why do they care so much about the observatory, the mob? I mean, is it that they want to make sure no science gets passed? It's the cultists that are doing this, right?
Yeah, the cult is chaining up the mob and saying, oh, everything we said was true, and if you want to go to heaven, you've got to do what we tell you, and we say destroy that observatory.
Because they want to make sure that no actual science gets passed on to future generations, because then that'll screw up the religious boom and subscriptions, right?
Exactly.
I guess that's sort of the same reason I don't let Heather read. I don't want her to think about the situation she's in.
No.
No outside voices. You know, they say use your inside voice. I say no outside voice.
Eitan asks Sheeran what to do, and he says nothing. As long as our men don't know, they should have enough time before total darkness descends, and they're 5 miles away from the city.
Sheeran is pretty sure that they're going to be safe. He says, it will take time to organize any really formidable mob, which lets me know that he's got some experience with that. You know, when we took out that snake man like 2 weeks ago, it was a good 90 minutes before we were firing on all pitchforks. So don't worry about it too much. You know what they say about mobs. You can have it fast, you can have it cheap, or you can have it good. You can't have all three.
Everyone gets back to work while Sheeran and Theramon go back to their chairs to stay out of the way. Sheeran asks him if he's having trouble breathing, to which Theramon says, no. And Sheeran looks like he is having some problems. And he says, you know, maybe I looked out that window a little too long.
That's funny when somebody's doing that. Do you guys feel nauseous? No. I don't either.
Bine, one of the scientists, comes over saying that he's done all of his work until the totality hits, and he wants to sit with them. Mm-hmm. Bine asks about the cultist and if he's causing any trouble, and Sheeran says, you know, no, he's being fine. And then he asks Bine if he's had trouble breathing, because he's still, you know, he wants somebody else to be having this problem here.
He won't admit it. He needs at least one other person to share the trouble before he'll admit to it. No? Yeah, I'm not having trouble breathing. I just something I like to know about people.
They complain about the cold, and they go back to Sheeran explaining why the indoor star sky experiment didn't work.
Any of you guys feeling homicidal? No? Yeah.
Me neither, man. I just...
Me neither.
Just checking. Sheeran explains that he believes that the stars might not even exist. That when the human mind is faced with absolute darkness, that it creates the illusion of stars. Then Theramon asks, why take pictures of it then? And he says, well, of course, to prove that they're not there, or that they are. You know, it's just proof one way or the other.
From behind them, they hear real quiet, when I'm in total darkness, I just imagine Jeremy. They turn around, huh? Oh, I'm sorry, were you guys talking? I didn't mean to interrupt, I'll just go back to work.
Bine pipes up and says he's got a theory about the stars. Not a real solid tested theory, just something that he's kind of been throwing around in his head. This idea that the stars are actually suns that are just really far away. Because they're so far away, they wouldn't influence the planet in line with their law of gravitation.
By golly, he's got it.
We know that that is correct.
Yeah.
But Bine suggests that there could be as many as 12 to even 24 stars out there. And Theramon says, whoa, if there's that many other stars out there, people's minds would be blown. We'd feel really insignificant.
Oh boy, you guys are in for it.
And it was at this point I knew where the story was going.
Yeah, that's what I was saying in the last episode. They seem to really understand this stuff. So why would they accept that maybe they'll go crazy, but it doesn't seem like they would. But then you go, oh, there's one simple thing they really don't understand.
The cult says that there are millions of stars out there, but that doesn't make any sense. Where would they all fit?
You can't. Yeah, how could you squeeze them all in there? That doesn't make sense at all.
So Sheeran thinks that people take, you know, many, like maybe a dozen or two stars, and they make it into insane numbers. They go, you know, it's thousands, it's millions.
That's just what people do. They hyperbolize. You're not starving. You're just a little hungry.
Exactly.
There aren't a million stars. There's like 12, 13 maybe.
Binet goes on to say that if you lived on a planet where you could see stars, you would be able to figure out how the universe moves just by looking up at the sky. No telescopes needed. But it wouldn't work. If you had a planet with only half day and half night, nothing could live on it. Because, you know, they have daytime all the time. And just then, Eitan is bringing out some lights. These lights seem to be like large torches. You know, they have like, it's a long, big stick with, and it has an open flame. On tall rods, they light up and the flame is about 6 inches high at the very top of them.
Oh, I see you've been to a mob as well.
At first, they seem really dim, but as Beta fades, they look quite brilliant. And Sheeran puts his hands to them to warm them. Even the cultist seems interested in these torches. Sheeran explains that they are made of wood. You take a pithy core of coarse water reeds, dry them thoroughly, and soak them in animal grease. Then you set fire to it, and the grease burns little by little. These torches will burn for almost a half an hour without stopping. Ingenious, isn't it?
So strange that they haven't already worked this out, but they always had light, so...
Necessity is the mother of invention.
And the way that I'm talking about it... I mean, I'm sure... that there's stuff about the natural world that we're sitting around ignoring that would be so obvious to somebody who had a different perspective.
Sure.
You know, if you're an alien, would be like, are you trying to convince me that the whole society functions without telekinesis? They just move things with their hands? Why don't they use their minds to do it?
What if we lived on a planet where there is only pockets of breathable air? You couldn't go further. You know, you could only live like in a little area, and then to go further out of it, you would have to come up with some kind of, you know, scuba or some kind of bell or something. I'm sure that they would have invented that a long time ago if that was the way the world was, because that would be necessary for them.
Yeah, I mean, or like, what if our lifespan was only like 80 years? You know, how weird would that be?
I'm not going to go there with you on that. It's all quiet now as people wait, most busying themselves. Theremin is still doing some notes for his article, which will probably never be published.
No.
But Theremin is the first to notice the sound. So quiet. He couldn't even really tell what the sound was. And then Theremin yells, Sheeran! And they all stop and look, and the sun is almost gone. Everything is getting dark. Eitan then shouts that the madmen from the city are coming, and Totality is going to be in 15 minutes, but the cultists will probably be there in 5.
Uh-oh.
So you've got a little bit of a drama going on here.
Uh-huh.
Sheeran says that the observatory is built like a fortress and should hold them off. On the way to close the doors, Sheeran clutches his chest. He can't breathe. His claustrophobia is overwhelming him, and he orders Theremin to do it. But Theremin's pretty afraid of the dark, and the lower part of the observatory is totally black. So Theremin runs up and grabs one of the torches. And they move lower, but they can hear people outside shouting and getting all crazy. But I was thinking, they're going to be blind soon enough. You know, like, it's getting really dark out there. They don't have torches. They don't know what's going on. And the building is very strong. It's got barred windows and really thick walls.
Yeah, they'll just wander off into the dark if you wait long enough.
Yeah. And they find that the back door is open. That's the way Latimer must have busted in, and they decide to barricade that with furniture.
I'm really angry, but I don't know where to direct it anymore.
But outside, they can hear bare fists pounding on the doors. You know, they kind of realize, oh, wait a minute. These people just got all ginned up. No real thought or planning went into this assault. So they just all marched up, you know, with no weapons, no source of...
Yeah.
Like, they didn't think it out at all. And now they're here, and it's getting super, super dark, and they're overwhelmed by fear. They're just freaking out. So they realize, yeah, these people aren't going to be a threat to us. So Theremin and Sheeran head up back to the dome.
Fast, cheap, or good. They opted for fast. Can't be good. That's a badly constructed mob. It's almost like the mob is irrelevant in a way because of that. They can't get in. But I feel like we're at the climax.
Yeah.
Asimov knows we got to ratchet up the tension a little bit. Yeah. And let's get a nice sound bed of people pounding on the doors outside. That'll really bring us to peak anxiety about what's going to happen.
Yeah. At the dome, Binet is telling folks to get ready to take pictures when the totality hits. If they feel themselves starting to freak out, they're supposed to get away from the cameras. Sheeran, still kind of freaking out, but keeping it mostly together, notices that Eitan is not around. So he gets Theremin to help him find Eitan. They feel around in the dark, and they find him, and they tell him that the cultists aren't going to be a problem. Latimer sits trying to figure out if there is a moral way around his pledge not to wreck all this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, well, you know, I was under duress, so I don't know if I'm actually held to it or not, but... and he's like, you know what? I can't stand this blasphemy. The gods would want me to do this, so I'm going to go ahead and destroy that camera. And he runs to go destroy it, but Theremin jumps on him and slams him to the ground, and he starts yelling at him. He's like, you double-crossing rat! And then It happens. Everyone gets quiet.
With the slow fascination of fear, he lifted himself on one arm and turned his eyes toward the blood-curdling blackness of the window. Through it shone the stars. Not Earth's feeble 3,600 stars visible to the eye. Lagash was in the center of a giant cluster. 30,000 mighty suns shone down in a soul-searing splendor that was more frighteningly cold in its awful indifference than the bitter wind that shivered across the cold, horribly bleak world. Pheromone staggered to his feet, his throat constricting him to breathlessness, all the muscles of his body writhing in an intensity of terror and sheer fear beyond bearing. He was going mad, and he knew it. And somewhere, deep inside, a bit of sanity was screaming, struggling to fight off the hopeless flood of black terror. It was very horrible to go mad and know that you were going mad. To know that in a little minute you would be here physically, and yet all the real essence would be dead and drowned in the black madness. For this was the dark. The dark and the cold and the doom. The bright walls of the universe were shattered, and their awful black fragments were falling down to crush and squeeze and obliterate him.
Thurman staggers over to the torches. Light, he screams. Aton is crying like a child, saying, stars, all the stars. We didn't know it all. We didn't know anything. We thought six stars in a universe is something the stars didn't notice is darkness forever and ever. And the walls are breaking in, and we didn't know we couldn't know anything.
Someone clawed at the torch, and it fell and snuffed out. In the instant, the awful splendor of the indifferent stars leaped nearer to them. On the horizon outside the window, in the direction of Sorrow City, a crimson glow began growing, strengthening in brightness that was not the glow of a sun. The long night had come again.
And that's the end of the story.
Yeah, I guess Emerson, in the context of this story, wasn't right that people would remember it forever as a glimpse into the city of heaven. In this case, John Campbell was right. Everybody went crazy.
Yeah.
But it was the immensity of it that drove them crazy.
The kind of the universal perspective. If you remember in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, when there was the box that you would go into and you would actually understand your position in the universe. And it would make you go nuts because incredibly insignificant you were. That is this.
Yeah.
These people just realize that they are absolutely nothing in this vast, vast universe. I mean, it's true. That's something that I think about, and I think I understand it from a logical standpoint. Like, our galaxy is 100,000 light years across, and there are billions and billions of other galaxies in the universe. Like, I can't even really get my head around how big the universe is.
Yeah, but you do need to get through life with a fiction of meaning.
Sure.
So it's cool. Yeah, I mean, this ends with some cosmic horror.
Oh, absolutely.
If you feel that you're at the center of the world and the things that you do have meaning, this revelation is chilling. I think that maybe you and I have muddled through life long enough knowing how insignificant we are. So it's not as much of the cosmic horror doesn't ring as loudly. But the thing about being insignificant is that anything could happen to you.
Sure.
And that's when it starts to get nerve-wracking if you think about it for too long.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, you can get yourself in a pretty dark place. But
right.
You just focus on the task at hand, generally.
Yeah, exactly. There's nothing I can do about any of that. No. So if you give up control, it's less scary.
Yeah.
Just work on what you're working on and let the rest sort itself out. And in that way, to me, it's kind of comforting.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I sit around feeling bad about myself and then I go, none of this matters. It shouldn't make me feel worse, but it makes me feel better.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've got some sliver of hope, almost a faith, I would say, that the totality of humanity will someday do great things and exist for millions of years in some form or another. But that's really a faith. That's not really kind of based in any kind of solid reality. And even if humanity did last for millions of years, our sun's going to last for billions of years still.
You know what? If a chihuahua and a chicken can get along together, anything's possible, man. And I have seen that with my own eyes.
Yeah, with your own eyes, really?
They're just, well, a video of it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Just not in person.
No, it's such a rare relationship that, you know, most of us won't be touched in our lifetime by witnessing that firsthand. If you did, you might go mad.
True.
I want to thank Andrew Lehman for being an amazing reader.
Yes.
Once again, as always.
Please go ahead and get to the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society's Cthulhu's.org and buy some raffle tickets for hurricane relief in Puerto Rico.
Yes, please help out. You will get a cool prop if you're lucky. If not, you'll just get the feeling of having done something with your miserable, insignificant life. Go buy those raffle tickets. Also want to thank Dave Infinity once again for selecting this story. You know, I'd never read it before, and you would think, heralded as it is as one of the best science fiction stories of all time, that I would have even heard of it, but I'm sorry to admit that I had.
No.
So thank you, Dave, for hipping me to it. I had a great time reading this.
Yeah.
It's a cool story.
It's such a cool
story.
I'm so
glad we're doing science fiction. There's so much to think about.
So what are we doing next week?
Next week, we are doing a story by Fritz Leiber, and it is another audience member selected it. It's called Space Time for Springers. I think it's a fun one. I think it has something to do with cats. I know that Leiber was a big cat fan.
Oh, so, okay.
Yeah, we might have some space cats again, which you know there's a space cat story out there. I want to read it.
Who doesn't? Come on.
Who doesn't? Ladies and gentlemen, that's what you can expect next on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I have been Chad Pfeiffer.
And I am still Chris Lackey. And you've been listening at hppodcraft.com.